Blog Talk Radio.
You may not be paid for the job.
Oh, and some of you will be
been humbled.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your fellow host, Cal and Tim. Today we are going to be discussing Islamic bullies, as you can kind of figure out with the title of the show, The Intimidation from the Scourge. And with that, I'm going to bring on the fellow host right now so that he can say hello as well.
Hello.
Hi,
there,
Tim.
Cal. Hello, Cal, and
how
are
you
tonight? I'm good, I'm good. How the devil are you?
Oh, I'm better after listening to Jeff's show yesterday. I'm feeling a little less frustrated.
Yeah.
I noticed
we had a few little teething problems with the audio yesterday, and then when I logged in tonight, just now, a couple of minutes ago, I couldn't get any audio initially, and I thought, oh, I hope it isn't going to be one of those evenings, but I'm pleased to say everything certainly sounds all right from my end, and you're as clear as a bell, Kel, clear as the proverbial Kel Bell, so that's what I'm going to call you.
Even my crunching pappy. Before we get to the topic here, I've been reading about the suicide bombings in Russia. I guess there was a second one.
That's right. I was listening
Volgograd.
To that. While I was out at Volgograd. I didn't know, actually. Volgograd used to be Stalingrad. I didn't realize they were actually one and the same place, but I guess they must have renamed it sometime in the not-too-distant past. But unfortunately, I fear this isn't going to be the last we're going to hear of it, because they're out to do, as far as I can see, they're out to cause maximum embarrassment to Russia in the run-up to the Winter Olympics. And I just think this is only the start. And, of course, things like that are very, very difficult to guard against if you've got, with the best will in the world, if you've got the best intelligence services in the world and the best security services, they have to be lucky all the time. And of course, with these Islamic nut jobs, they've only got to be lucky once. So I fear this isn't the last we've heard. But there we go.
And there you go. This is the North Caucasus behind this, absolutely. Nobody's claiming a responsibility for them, but we know it's the North Caucasus. It has to be.
It has to be. I mean, I don't see any other group with grievances in that part of the world that would resort to those tactics, apart from the problems that they've been having in Dagestan and Chechnya. So, it's got to be. All right. I don't want to make any predictions, but I mean that's obviously the way it's shaping up at the moment. And the chap who's leading the Islamists out there is on record as saying that he wants to produce maximum embarrassment for Russia on the run.
Oh yeah, that's rebel leader Dokhayumarov. He's been threatening attacks all over the place.
Yes, indeed. So I expect we'll hear a lot more. But I think one of the suicide bombers was reported. At least this is what I heard on the last news bulletin, as being a woman who had previously lost her husband in fighting against Russia from one of the Russian provinces. So I don't know.
Oh.
I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a lot more recruits from that sort of area, because we've had those in the past, haven't we? With what they call the Black Widows, and it's not an exclusively a Russian thing, but it does seem to be on the increase. Where if they've had a militant husband who has been killed at some point in the past, that seems to make them more prone to following in the footsteps.
What worries me is that this is the same area where the Sarnoff Boston, but those two brothers, the Boston bombers, they came from that area, the North Caucasus. What I'm worried about is immigration now. I mean, I think we better close the gates on immigration from that area as well.
Well,
another area.
Unfortunately, I think it's going to be a case of locking the stable door after the horse has bolted, because I don't know what it's like in Canada, but we seem to have been welcoming all and sundry in the way of Muslim immigration without doing any checks at all about the backgrounds on some of these people and whether or not they've come from areas that are particularly prone to radicalization or whether or not they've become radicalized since they've got into the, come into the country. Nobody seems to be doing any checks at all, and we're just storing up a lot of problems for ourselves, I feel. And even if we were to shut the doors tomorrow to Muslims coming in from those areas, or indeed if we were to shut the doors tomorrow to all Muslim immigration, we would still have an awful lot of weeding through to do to be sure that we could get rid of the radicalized ones here. And I just fear it would be an impossible task.
Actually, Canada is taking note of some of these issues. We're overhauling our citizenship rules, for one, and I think Canada is working on getting rid of dual citizenship, because in particular when Lebanon had the issues going on there, the Lebanese, they had dual citizenship, but they were residing there in Canada when it but because they were technically Canadian citizens, Canada had an obligation to get them out of there while the strife was going on. But when everything settled down, they all went back. And we're also working on a way to get rid of the anchor baby clause when rich Saudi women come over when they're 7 months pregnant, and they stay here and they give birth, and their child is granted automatic Canadian citizenship. Canada is going to be scrapping that one, we hope, as well. This is what they're trying to do. So we're also ramping up when you can apply for citizenship and how you can apply for citizenship, and you have to prove that you're going to be residing in Canada and not be here long enough to obtain citizenship, just to go back to your host country, or home country, rather. So Canada is making a few moves, but I still don't think it's enough.
Well, I have to agree with you. I think it's likely to be too little too late, unless something really bad happens. And I just hope it isn't going to take that to wake up the political elites and the mainstream media to the problems that have been allowed to develop. I think mm-hmm. almost certainly... in the UK, it is going to take something like that to wake up our political elites and our mainstream media. And even then, I don't know what the response will be. I mean, if we look back to what we had over here back in 2005, I think, on the 7/7 bombings, the very first thing, of course, was everybody who had a voice in mainstream media and in our political elites was saying, don't rush to judgment. Don't blame a handful of Muslims for the problems that are being caused, or rather, don't tar the whole Muslim community for the problems caused by one or two extremists. You know, it's only a tiny, tiny minority of extremists. And I feel we'll still hear that even after the next atrocity. We're still going to get people like David Cameron standing up. Look what he did at in Woolwich with the slaughter of Lee Rigby on the street. I mean, the blood was hardly dry on the street when he stood up and said, this has nothing to do with Islam, even though Michael Adebolajo had been caught on camera with the machete in his bloody hands, quoting from Chapter 9 of the Quran. David Cameron, he's still up there saying even now that we should be more like British Muslims. It shouldn't be them that's adapting to us. It should be us that's adapting to them. I mean, the guy is fast becoming an embarrassment, and I just dread to think what he's going to come up with the next time we have something happen on our streets. I'm sure it's going to take an awful lot more than one life being lost before our political elites wake up and start seeing it for what it really is. But we've just got to keep getting that message out there. And I'm certainly going to be doing my bit in the next couple of months, that's for sure. I've got a little... Sorry, go on. Go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that the other attacker, Michael Adebowale, why can't they have normal names? You know, why can't they be Smith? Adebowale. I heard that he's renounced Islam.
Well, that's an interesting... that's an interesting piece of news. I hadn't heard that myself. He didn't have a lot to say for himself, either at the time or when he was in custody or when he was in court. I don't think he said very much at all, did he? I think he didn't say a word.
No.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how much weight you can put on that little bit of news. Who was reporting it? Can you recall where that bit of news came from? I only ask because I hadn't heard it myself. I'm not saying that it isn't true.
Yeah.
But
I'm just trying to bring it up to see if I can.
But yeah, I mean
the other guy,
Michael Adebolajo, I mean he was doing us all a favour by standing up straight after the murder and in court and saying the reason I did this was because of Islam and the teachings of the Quran. And he was basically standing there and saying, if you follow the Quran and the teachings of Islam in the way that they should be followed, then there is really no other course of action that you can do. You know, if you're going to put your hand on your heart and say, I am going to follow the dictates of the Quran and the commands of the Islamic ideology, what he did was totally in character with those Islamic commands. It was totally in the spirit of Islam, and devout Muslims out there, you would think, are now pondering exactly what they can do to follow in his footsteps, because I'm sure there will be some out there that will say, yeah, that's exactly what Allah would want us to do, and they're only waiting for the opportunity. And I'm sure there's more than one or two of them out there who would happily give up their lives for the opportunity to cause carnage on our streets, and yet our political elites are still parroting the mantra, this has nothing to do with Islam, where in fact it has everything to do with Islam. And a lot of the things would, a lot of the cognitive dissonance that we currently experience when we see what Muslims around the world are doing in the name of Islam, and then we listen to what our political elites are saying, a lot of that cognitive dissonance would disappear if everybody listened to what people like you and I had to say, because we can see exactly what is going on, and our listeners can listen to what we're saying, and they can see for themselves exactly what's going on. And if you take the view that Islam is primarily a political totalitarian ideology, which it is, and you've got all sorts of evidence to back that up, which I won't go into right now, but the only rational conclusion you can come to if you do your research on the history of Islam over the last 1400 years and the history of jihad and the analysis of the Quran done by such worthy people as Bill Warner of Political Islam, there is no other conclusion that you can realistically come to. But so few people take the trouble to undertake that sort of research, and so few people want to believe that there is this big scary problem out there called Islam, that they are happy to listen to the likes of David Cameron parroting the lies and parroting the mantra that it's nothing to do with Islam. But sooner or later, we are all going to come to terms with it.
And I just found the article where I read that. It was from the Daily Mirrors from December 22nd. Apparently, Adebowale, he suffered a psychotic episode in which he renounced the Quran and he renounced Islam, and he was transferred to the Broadmoor Hospital.
And they're calling that a psychotic episode, I would say.
Yeah, he had a psychotic episode,
Adebowale,
where he was saying, I denounce...
That looks like, I was going to say, Kel, it sounds like that's a return to sanity, not a psychotic. They've got it completely the wrong way around. It's a psychotic.
I always thought that he was the ringleader and Adebowale went along with it. I don't know, but yeah, apparently Adebowale, he had a psychotic episode and he renounced Islam. So there you go.
Oh, okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see if any of the other mainstream media pick up on that. I don't suppose now he's behind bars and he's by necessity he's going to have relatively little contact with the outside world. I don't know how much we're going to get in the way of independent confirmation about that, but it's still an interesting little snippet of news, and I'd be interested to see if anybody else can provide any additional information about it. But
I'm not too sure about this particular news source. I'm not familiar with them, so I don't know.
The Daily Mirror is a somewhat sensationalist newspaper, and I'm not sure that I would give a great deal of weight to what they say unless it was backed up with some additional sources, independent sources. But you know, nevertheless, I mean, it's still an interesting thing. You know, if he wasn't fully committed, I mean, with Islam, if you're going to go around killing people on the street, you had better be fully committed to it, because obviously there are consequences that are involved. And if you're not fully committed to it, and then you're suddenly faced with the enormity of what you have done and the realization that you're going to be spending the rest of your life behind bars, I mean, that is enough to make a lot of people think very carefully about what they have done. So even if it's a belated conversion or an apostatization from Islam, I'd say it was welcome. If it hadn't already been for the events that had transpired and the death of Lee Rigby, if all that had happened was he'd done something slightly naughty and then he decided he was going to convert from Islam back to a proper religion or no religion at all, then that would be one thing. Mm. But as he's obviously done something for which he's unlikely to get any pardon from, well, I would hope he's unlikely to get any pardon or any early release from prison for the rest of his life, hopefully. But it would be nice if we could get his story and have it printed as a cautionary tale to other people who might be thinking going down the same route. But I doubt very much whether our political elites are even thinking along those lines. I mean, even if the Daily Mirror reports it and they say, oh, he's apostatized from Islam, he's obviously having a psychotic episode, then there's very little hope anything positive to come out of it. But it's an interesting
story. Aberration.
An aberration, yes, that's right. Anyway, Kel,
he's not normal.
Sorry, go on. Sorry.
I was just saying, it's not normal to denounce Islam. I find that funny that they would treat it as a psychotic episode. Maybe the guy just woke up.
That's
I don't know.
What we really need is a few more stories in the mainstream media from people who have apostatized from Islam, and they should be given front page positions, really, or at least prominent positions in the media to get the message out to say why they have apostatized from Islam. But they don't. The mainstream media doesn't treat them as an asset which could be used to provide or to contribute to the solution to the problems that we have. I mean, I always say, when we're talking about the encroachment of Islamization in this country, I get a lot of people say to me, it's a really, really bad situation and we can't do anything about it and it's too late and anything we do, it'll be too little. I mean, I have to say I disagree. I think that with constant reinforcement of the message that you and I and countless other counter-jihadists put out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Blog Talk Radio. I think we can turn this around. It's a bit like the Titanic heading towards the iceberg, I admit,
mm-hmm.
but at least we do have the tools that we need in order to make a difference, which is something, as I have said before on this show, something that our forefathers, our ancestors never had. When Islam suddenly came upon their societies, they didn't have the means to do the research that we have. They didn't have the means to disseminate the message. If they'd done the research and they discovered the truth about Islam in the way that we have, they didn't have the means to disseminate the message that we have. We can get that message around the world in a heartbeat now, and our ancestors never had a chance to do that. So I'm full of optimism for what we can accomplish using the tools we have. And I think that, it would be nice if the mainstream media also recognized that there was this problem and said to themselves, hey, we could use the stories of the guys who have apostatized from Islam and their reasons for doing it, and we could put these stories on in prominent positions in the newspapers and on TV and on, well, all sorts of mainstream media. I mean, obviously, we do get apostates from Islam that come onto Blog Talk Radio. I think you yourself have had one or two, Kel, and I know Mike Holt from Restore Australia has had one or two on his show.
Yeah, I think
it would be, we could get them on mainstream media and get them to get their message out there, it would be tremendously helpful. But at the moment, the mainstream media is not on our side, and I think it'll take something awful to happen before we actually start getting the mainstream media on our side and start doing useful things like that instead of carrying water for the enemy.
Well, actually, there's one apostate who has a radio program right here on Blog Talk Radio Friday evenings at 11 p.m., and that's Dr. Mark Christian with Corey Miller. And he talks about Islam, the issues of Islam on the Radio Jihad Network.
Oh,
so
great.
That is one good thing. Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. I do know to get these
yeah,
people on.
What I'll do.
I was thinking, wouldn't it be nice if we could get them on mainstream media? You know, if we could get them on the front page.
Yeah.
The Daily Telegraph or The Guardian. Oh, excuse me while I sit down and laugh. On the front page of The Guardian, not a chance. But it would be, you know.
The Guardian. I like The Guardian because they have all the pictures in there. As a matter of fact, oh, we got Poppy in the chat room and she can't hear us. She's been trying to refresh and refresh and refresh. Here. Okay.
Okay. Is there something you can do to help Poppy there, Kel? I'll try another browser.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I could try to refresh the studio. This is very frustrating, though. Here, let me see if I can't do this.
Okay. Do you need me?
What I'm going to do.
Do you want me to carry on?
No, nope, you're
what
fine.
What's happening?
I'm going to go completely out and come right back in. And see what I can't do there.
Do you carry on talking, or do you want me just to hold fire while you do that?
Oh, no, continue talking.
Oh, all right, then. What I was saying was it would be nice if we could get the mainstream media, the TV and newspapers in particular, on our side when it comes to fighting the Islamization in various countries in the West. At the moment, as I was saying to Kel, we do have people on social media, such as Blog Talk Radio, who have apostatized from Islam and who do give us their stories, and that is a start. But if we could persuade the mainstream media to give us more airtime, I'm not holding out a lot of hope for newspapers like The Guardian and from left-wing organisations such as the BBC, but surely there must be some mainstream news channels out there, maybe in the United States, if not in the UK, where such people might be welcomed and their stories might
mm-hmm.
serve as a cautionary tale to not only to people who are thinking maybe of toying with the idea of taking up or converting to Islam, but also for those of us non-Muslims who don't really yet fully understand the extent of the problem. All those kind of all those kind of media outlets that currently are being so quiet and are carrying water for Islam and just generally not helping with solving the long-term problems at all, it would be nice to get them on our side. But I don't know what it will take for that to actually come to pass. I don't see it. I don't see it happening in the foreseeable future, and well, certainly in the next few months.
No,
anyway.
And that's what brings us to our topic for today, and that is the Islamic bully. And I was reading this article from Front Page Magazine, and they're equating them to the schoolyard bully. And I love this analogy from the article that I have in front of me, is that not especially large or strong, the schoolyard bully, generally a prickly, nasty fellow, picks on two groups. One, those who are obviously weaker than him, and two, those who are, while larger or stronger than him, willingly give to him, willingly appease. Bullying the first group, the weak, is an easy matter for the bully. As for the second group, those capacities and responses are unclear. These he must first determine through a few bully trial runs to see whether they will fight back or whether they will give in. He begins small, a shove and a harsh word here and there, and takes it from there, always seeing how far he can go.
Yeah, I've found the article that you were referring to. It's from 2012, and the schoolyard bully is a very good analogy, and that is the position that we find ourselves in at the moment. In fact, with a lot of the characteristics that we see of Muslims when they are large enough in number to make their presence known. This is an important factor, and it's something that we have discussed previously on the previous shows, where if you've just got Muslims in a very, very small percentage of the population, like less than 1%, it's never really much of a problem. And the perception is that these people are part of our multicultural society, making up adding to the rainbow diversity of our Western nations, and we see all sorts of positive attributes. You know, we say, oh well, they've got really nice exotic Middle Eastern food. You know, they might dress a bit funny, but they're not seen as a threat. But of course, once you start getting above 1% or so of the population, then the paradigm changes, and the Muslim attitudes to the host population change. And the analogy of a schoolyard bully, as the population increases, becomes very apt. And in fact, a lot of the characteristics are similar to characteristics that you would expect from a small child as they're growing up. You know, you think of a two-year-old toddler, okay? If he can't get what he wants, he throws a tantrum. He doesn't sit down and say, well, look here, Mum and Dad, I know I want this, and I know you don't want to give it to me, but how about if I'm good for the next few days, how about you give me this instead of that, and maybe we can all grow up, all play nicely? But that doesn't happen, of course, with a two-year-old. A two-year-old will just throw a tantrum, and it's exactly the same with Muslims in the host population. If they don't get what they want, and they're more than 1 or 2% of the population, you start to see those characteristics coming through very strongly. And while it may just be a minor irritation when they're only a small percentage of the population, if they throw a tantrum because they don't get what they want, okay, it's easy enough. Maybe on this one occasion we'll give them what they want, because then maybe they'll integrate and assimilate, and then maybe the problem will go away. But of course, the problem never does go away, because the Muslim attitude is one they see that as weakness, and so they capitalize on that, and it becomes stronger and stronger, and then the schoolyard bully analogy really kicks in, and it's not just I'll throw a tantrum if you don't give me what I want, it's I will actually start to get violent and cause physical harm to you and to those around you, and generally interfere with your way of life if I don't get what I want. So the schoolyard bully
is a
very...
I'm just going to pause it right here, Tim. Nobody in the chat room can hear us.
Oh, no. Oh,
yeah,
no.
They've lost sound. Yeah, Poppy can't hear. Moving can't hear. Nobody can hear us. So I don't know what the heck is going on.
What do you want me to do? Do you want me to... Well, what do you want me to do?
Well, what I did is I tried refreshing the studio, and obviously that didn't work. And what I can probably do is get a live coach right now and tell them, look, nobody can hear us in the studio. And if you want to continue on with the topic while I disappear for about 2 seconds and do that.
Yeah, I'll carry on. I suppose if you and I can hear each other, then at least we can say once this show goes to archive, we ought to be able to just tidy it up and rebuild
it.
Just a bit of a new
everybody
wants
everybody will be able to hear it in archive, but it's just frustrating. These people go out of their way to be here and they can't hear the show. That's not fair to them. Oh, and actually Luchadora just said she can hear us fine,
and
Golf Dog can hear us. Oh, okay. So it might just be the browser that they're using.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I had this problem right at the start. Now, I'm using Google Chrome, and I was logged into Skype, and then I clicked on the link to the Blog Talk Radio show. The Blog Talk Radio show website came up. The start time came and went, and I had no sound. But what I found was that when I tried to connect using the Skype dial-in button, after I had made that connection, it all came back. So I don't know if that's any help at all. Maybe if somebody actually can't hear you, if they try using the Skype button to dial in, even if they don't necessarily want to talk themselves on the show, maybe that's something they could do. I don't really know what else
that's
to suggest.
That's been happening, that's been happening to a lot of radio hosts again this week. As a matter of fact, Mary, she's been having to call in to sit there in the studio and listen because she can't get, when she goes to the chat room, she can't hear anything. So she has to call in and quietly sit there and listen in the studio. It's very frustrating, and it's throwing me off my game because Tim and myself, we go through a great deal of effort to bring you the finest show that we possibly can. And when we have these issues, it's very, very frustrating. And Tim is a pro. Me, not so much. I get thrown off my game quite easily, and this just threw me off. And so I'm not happy.
Oh, you're too kind, Kel. I mean, I have to say, I wouldn't say you're very kind, but I don't consider myself to be a pro on this, but I did have a very similar problem with the Blog Talk Radio when I last had a Liberty GB show. I'd advertised it as going live at 5 o'clock one evening, and 5 o'clock came and went, and I couldn't get this show to start at all. It was actually Blog Talk Radio's fault, and they did apologise, and it did all go all right in the archive eventually. It was just a bit embarrassing. So I'm at the point now where I'm expecting the occasional technical error to come up more often than not, and I'm just a little sorry. I haven't got any additional suggestions for you, apart from suggesting to people if they want to dial in using the skippity Skype button and sit in the studio quietly, then they may well be able to hear. And, of course, the upside is, if they want to, they can also chip in with a little bit of comment of their own, and they might like
absolutely.
To do that.
Absolutely.
So maybe that's
absolutely.
Something.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I mean, if you want to just type that into the chat room as a possible suggestion for people, we can carry on.
Oh, it looks like we've got Poppy back.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Moving couldn't hear. He left.
Oh, okay. That's too bad.
He might just be doing a little bit of refreshing or going to a different browser as well. But, okay, it's beyond our control. Some people can hear us, some can't. So whether that's Blog Talk Radio or the individual browser, I have no idea. But I know that if everybody listens in archive, you'll hear us fine. So... onward and upward, Tim.
Okay.
Back to these bullies.
Back to
these
the bullies. Okay. So what, where I'd got to was saying that the schoolyard bully analogy is a very good one,
mm-hmm.
and the childish attributes that we see in the schoolyard bully are just a continuation of the childish attributes that we see when the two-year-old toddler has his temper tantrum. And it's exactly the same with Muslims in the home, in the host population. When they're relatively small in number, if there's something that happens that they don't like, they throw a temper tantrum. They don't sit down and write letters to the Guardian like you and I would do. It's straight to the old temper tantrum. If we don't get our way, we're going to make a fuss. And they do that because it works, because a lot of people don't want to see Muslims upset. They make the mistake of assuming that Muslims have the same value system as the rest of us, and that if we make one or two small concessions, then that will be enough for Muslims to integrate and to assimilate with the rest of us, and we can all live happily ever after. But of course, because Muslims don't have the same value systems that we do, nothing of the sort will ever happen. Muslims will see our concessions as being a sign of weakness, and what turns from the temper tantrum when they're a toddler, to use the analogy, when there's not so many of them in the population, when they start to become more numerous in the population, the behavior changes to that of the schoolyard bully, and it isn't just the temper tantrum, it goes to physical violence, threats, intimidation, which is really very frightening to civilized Western people. We are not the warlike warrior caste that perhaps we once were. I'm not talking about our military here, who are specially trained to exhibit just those characteristics. I'm talking about the average person in the street who just wants to keep a roof over his head, go to work, bring home enough to feed his family and educate his children, and just to generally have what we in the West would consider to be a pleasant lifestyle. He does not want to have that lifestyle affected by the antics of Muslims. So the tendency is, as a whole in our society, when Muslims act up in the way that they do, the reaction that many people in authority have to their eternal shame is to capitulate and to appease and to give the Muslims what they want in the hope that the problem will go away. But of course, the problem will never go away, because the Muslims, having a different value system to the rest of us, will see it as weakness. And this is at the root of the entire problem with Muslims immigrating into the West, is that their value system is completely opposed to the values of our traditional Judeo-Christian values, and so we can't expect them to react in the same way as rational, civilized human beings would when they're presented with that sort of threat.
And that's exactly it, in that, in reading this article, sorry, I'm getting distracted in the chat room.
Yeah,
people are not getting any sound.
I can see that. I think all we can really do is just type a couple of messages into the chat room saying we are aware of the problem. Try using the Skippity Skype button to dial in to the show and see if that helps. And if they use the Skippity Skype button and hit the number one on the dial pad so that they appear in the studio, if their experience is anything like mine, they should be able to hear you. Holger seems to have no problem. So all I can suggest is we put that message in and see if we can. We might have to repeat that message every so often through the show, Kel. But other than that, I'm not sure what else I can suggest.
Okay, Holger is here. Yep, he just logged in. Yep, and maybe everybody can just either try refreshing or Skype in and sit in the studio with us, and we'll give you tea and biscuits.
Yeah, that's it. Tea and biscuits is our speciality. But yeah, seriously, folks, if you want to, if you lose the sound, if you can hear us at the moment, but you do lose the sound, try re-Skyping in and call up the dial pad and hit number one on the dial pad so that you're sitting in the studio for me, because I had a similar problem right at the start, and I found that as soon as I was in the studio, the sound came back. So maybe that's something you can try. And as I said to Kel, it also means that if you want to chip in and have your 2 cents worth on the show, you're right there. You don't have any kind of delay at all. You can be right there and
that's right.
2 cents worth.
What I'm going to do, though, I think I'm going to play a song, and I'm going to get in touch with Blog Talk Radio and see if they can't do anything.
Okay, well, I mean, while you're doing that, do you want me to come back in when the song finishes and just pick it up from...
Yes.
Or would you like me to do?
Yeah, I'm going to play a song, and if I'm still with the live coach, you can just take it from there, Tim.
Yep. Okay. No problem. Leave it with me.
Okay, guys. We'll be back in about 3 minutes.
Appeasement. Appeasement. Dressed up as political compromise. It's immediate. The benefits seem immediate
and popular.
And tangible.
Profitable.
At what price? But is it not an illusion? Are we not kidding ourselves? I'm just staving off the day of reckoning. Can evil ever be compromised? Ever be compromised? Evil will live on. 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 Evil will live on.
Sacrifice our principles in the name of diplomacy,
tolerance, intolerance.
Shake hands with those who hate us. Can they ever be satisfied?
Could a foreign flag yet fly over Paris, London, Rome, and Washington?
They want to take over, dominate their neighbor, domestic demand, it's on the culture requiring capitalistic congressmen.
Democracy last long, or will it waste, exhaust, and murder itself? Will democracies commit suicide?
Welcome back, everybody, and I'm talking with a life coach right now to figure out why people are not getting, some people are getting sound and some people are not, and good old Neil, support operator, is my life coach, and so I'm talking with him. But getting back to the program and the topic at hand, we are talking about Western appeasement to the Islamic bullies, and why are we doing that? And one thing that Tim was touching on before we ran into our technical issue is that it's not quite to me, it's not quite understandable, Tim. Like, why are they doing this? Like, there's just taken from the article again, from the Front Page Magazine article, is that the bully will receive one or two responses from the second group, those not smaller or weaker than him, either appeasement and giving in or a punch in the nose. Why are we not giving them a punch in the nose?
Well, the answer to that, of course, Kel, is that exactly what we should be giving them. And if we had given them that metaphorical punch to the nose back, I don't know, 20 years ago or 20, 30 years ago, when we first started to realize that there was a problem with Islamic immigration, I think a lot of people must have realized, and I'm talking 20, 30 years ago, because that's really when Islamic immigration started to increase on an exponential scale. I'm sure a lot of people in power at that time did realize that there was something wrong but couldn't quite put their finger on it because, hey, you know, Islam is a religion of peace, yeah? Just an ordinary religion, exactly the same as Judaism and Christianity. Therefore, it's obviously not that that's causing the problem. That was pretty much the mindset, I imagine, of people who were in positions of power 20 or 30 years ago in our political elites and at the top of our mainstream media. And they certainly didn't want to stigmatize Islam for the actions of what might have been then a small portion of the population. But of course, as the problem has grown, nobody has really looked into the root causes of what's behind this behaviour. We have, obviously, you and I, Kel, and other people who have taken up the counter-jihad fight have looked into it, and we're all coming to the same conclusion, hardly unsurprisingly, that the problem is within the Islamic doctrines. And simply trying to write it off as being a problem that's inherent only with a tiny percentage of the Muslim population is not doing anybody any favours in the long term. But I guess a lot of people are thinking, well, you know, my career could be on the line here if I take a decision which stigmatises the whole of the Muslim population and I actually come out and say there is a problem with Islam and we ought to be dealing with it as a political ideology. Well, that could be my career down the plug hole, you know, and I've worked long and hard for this career. That might be the mindset of people who currently make up our political elites. And then they've got votes to think about. You know, what happens if they come out with a statement like this and they lose a substantial proportion of their Muslim vote as a result? Or even worse, what happens if somebody in charge of the oil in Saudi Arabia gets to hear about it and cuts off the flow of oil to those Western countries that start to recognize publicly the truth behind what is happening? So there's all sorts of reasons why we haven't given that schoolboy bully a punch on the nose when we should have done. None of them are good reasons in the long term. I can understand why they have done it in the short term, because everybody wants a quiet life. Maybe the problem will go away, even if the problem doesn't go away. By the time the brown stuff hits the air cooling device, I will be long gone with my gold-plated pension in my holiday cottage in the Bahamas behind my gated community. Why would I want to stir things up? And I'm sure this is the short-termism, again, it's something we have talked about on previous shows. I'm sure that's a contributing factor as well. But yeah, the answer is we should have given that schoolyard bully a punch to the nose by saying, in effect, your behaviour is not acceptable, and if you want to continue to live and to prosper and to thrive in Western countries, you are going to have to shape up. And it'll either come to that, either we are going to have to give that bully a punch to the nose, or we are going to lose the civilization that we have if we don't. And my personal view, as I'm sure most regular listeners to this show already know, is that if we lose the civilization that we have, that our forefathers fought and died for, because we are too afraid. If we were too afraid to give that bully a punch on the nose when he needed it, what are we going to say to our children and grandchildren who are going to bear the brunt of this problem? Because when the problem gets really serious, and it will, when the jihad comes to our streets, and it will, our children are going to come to us with tears in their eyes, and our grandchildren with tears in their eyes, and they're going to say, why didn't you do something, Dad or Granddad or Grandma? Why didn't you do something when you could have done something? And I, for one, am not going to be in that position, and I don't care if it costs me my liberty or my life, which it might, because when you speak out against these things, nobody is ever going to say... I am never going to say to anybody, I didn't realise there were consequences. I realised right from the start when I started speaking out against Islam that one day there might well be consequences. And those consequences could be quite serious. And those consequences have been very serious for people who have spoken out in the past against what they see as the threat of Islam. Two obvious examples I'm thinking of, from the Netherlands. 2002, Pim Fortuyn, who was assassinated for speaking out against Islam. He was a very prominent, very popular politician. And a couple of years after that, in 2004, also in the Netherlands, Theo van Gogh, who was slaughtered in the street for making a satirical film about Islam. These things can have consequences. And, you know, anybody who is faint-hearted, I would say... You know, all I would say to you is if you don't feel you can join the counter-jihad fight, then stand back and let us do it. You know, don't stand in our way because it's going to get messy. And every time one of us takes to the airwaves like this and says the things that we do, somebody somewhere might just be clocking the fact that we have been saying these things and might be storing up retribution for a future date. So, you know, I'm not saying this to frighten people, and I'm not saying it to, you know, make out that I'm braver than I am, because I'm no more brave than the next person. But I do realise that speaking out has consequences. But I can do nothing else. I feel so strongly, as I'm sure most of the listeners to our show feel, I feel so strongly about this threat to our civilization. And make no mistake, you know, it is an existential threat. Our civilization is arguably the best mechanism ever devised by mankind for the betterment of humanity, our Judeo-Christian civilization. It's not perfect. I'd never argue that it's perfect. And I'm not saying that there haven't been some people who've come into contact with our Judeo-Christian civilization and perhaps come off second best as a result, and they might have no love for it. But when you're talking about the greatest good for the greatest number, I believe that... going forward from this point, the Judeo-Christian values and traditions that our civilization has engendered are far, far superior to anything that Islam could possibly produce now or in the future. I think the Judeo-Christian civilizational model is much, much superior to anything we've ever seen before. The Islamic civilizational model is a very poor civilizational model. It produces nothing but poverty and misery for the most part. And the only way that Islam can stay in existence and expand in the way it has done is through fear, violence, intimidation, and terror. And of course, it's the intimidation part of it that is of concern to us tonight. If it was only the violence part of it, okay, by which I mean if all we had to worry about was the Islamic military threat, we could squash that in a heartbeat. We have vastly superior military capability to any Islamic country, or even arguably against the entire Islamic world combined. If it was purely a military threat, we could squash it overnight. But it isn't. It's the subtle intimidation and insinuation of Muslims into our Western society that causes problems.
That's absolutely what it is. And I mean, they move. They're very, very stealthy. And Tim, we have a caller who wants to come on the air and chat with us, and
okay.
I'll bring him on right now, and that's 4707. Hi, welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with Cal and Tim. What's your name and what's your comment or question?
Oh, hey, this is me, Moving. How you doing?
Oh, hello,
hi, Moving. How are you?
I just called in because I couldn't get the show on the program today, but I'll,
yeah,
I'll never say any words, and I'll be glad to comment today. I was able to pick up enough where I understand that, you know, where is the threat coming from? Well, the threat's coming from, you know, in the U.S., our government. I mean, the President mm-hmm. of the United States has been accused of being a member of the, you know, Muslim Brotherhood. And there's a lot of, you know, senior and learned people making that assertion. And the list
oh,
is
Oh, Moving, absolutely. Absolutely. And that was something that this article that I'm reciting from has strongly alluded to. And everybody, the Carl speech, when soon after Barack Hussein Obama took office, he made it quite clear numerous ways that he was intent on appeasing the Muslims. I mean, whether by bowing to the Wahhabi king, commanding NASA, canceling the space program because he wanted to make Muslims feel better about themselves, for example, censoring security language deemed insulting to Muslims, or giving terrorists Osama bin Laden an Islamic funeral. Like, no American president has been more appeasing to the Muslim world than Barack Hussein Obama. Right, Moving?
Well, I can't argue with that. I know that's where all my tax dollars went, is overseas
mm-hmm.
and caused a deficit. You know, it's about time we bring all our troops home and let those folks solve their own problems.
What really angered me this week was when I read an article, and once again this was from Front Page Magazine, and Syria canceled Christmas. Christians can no longer celebrate Christmas. And Obama is still giving them money to the tune of, it's going to total $14 billion. He's still, these people are being persecuted, and this guy is still giving them financial aid. What is wrong with this person?
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. the problem, I guess, from my perspective is that, you know, our government here is the Congress is supporting him, and that's even worse than Obama. It's the Congress actually supporting these Muslims, these Christian haters, these Christian killers. That's scary.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, and yes, yeah, like Syria, like another one, another, and he's backing up the rebels. This guy. Well, he's actually what he's doing is that he's backing up the Al-Qaeda embedded rebels in Syria as well, and that bothers me a lot. And that it's a well-known fact that Al-Qaeda has embedded with the rebels, and we don't know who the rebels are, and we don't know who the Al-Qaeda are. And now they're making these decrees, and he's still funding them. It just makes me ill. But
well, the whole
there
West
are
is,
bullies
is cow-towing.
Amongst us. Mm-hmm. Things like the CARE, Council for American Islamic Relations, and how he's appeasing them. CARE is an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation, in which they were found to be laundering money to support the Palestinian movement, those so-called Palestinians. I call them the Palestinians. And he is more than happy to have the money laundering going on to fund these Palestinians in their movement to push Israel into the sea. This is the United States of America, one of the most, well, it is the, it, well, under Obama, we're going to have to say it used to be the most powerful nation on the planet. This guy is determined to destroy the United States from the inside out as well.
There's also the fact, I mean, one of the first things that Muvin said when he came on was the reference to Obama being a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I suppose the question mm-hmm. to ask is, if he wasn't a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, what would he be doing? What would he be doing differently? You know, it's just everything that he's done has been in accordance with what a devout Muslim who was following the dictates of the Muslim Brotherhood would have done. And I've often asked the question: how is it that Obama gets away with all these things and basically walking all over the Constitution and breaking every moral and ethical barrier that you would think would be in his way without any kind of anybody stepping up and stopping him? And I did ask the question, why hasn't he been impeached? And I did get quite an interesting article back, which I'm posting in the chat room now, which basically says that the mechanics of the way that the Congress and the Senate and the House of Representatives work means that impeachment is actually a very unlikely thing to happen, no matter what he does. And I find that very, very depressing if it is true as it's laid out in that article, because the whole idea was that when the Constitution was set up, it was to guard against tyranny such as this, and it almost beggars belief that somebody like Obama can just walk all over the constitutional protections Americans are supposed to enjoy. I really do feel strongly for those Americans out there, which is pretty much to say, you know, pretty much all Americans, because you're going to be in for a tough time. And I'm not an American myself, as I'm sure our listeners probably know, but I have spent time in America, and I've always found the people I've met over there to have been the most courteous, charming people I've ever met. And I'm really, really sorry to see what is happening under Obama in your country, but nevertheless, miracles do sometimes happen, so I think we should all pray very hard tonight for a miracle. But I just thought I'd post that article in the chat room so people could just have a look in case they are wondering why nothing has been done, as I'm sure many non-Americans do wonder. There are some things in here which could give you a few ideas.
Oh, yeah, and Tim, just to let people know, if you're an archive listener and you cannot access the chat room because you're listening in archive, I've put that article on the Red Fox Blogger, so you can go to redfoxblogger.blogspot.com, and it's there. It should be near the top of the page for you.
Oh, yep, thanks, Kel. Good. Okay, moving. Sorry, we've interrupted you a little bit, moving. Would you like to carry on with your thread, with what you were saying?
Well, I really called in to listen, so you can, you know, take me offline. But I would encourage everyone. I would encourage everyone to look at Reverend Manning's videos out of Harlem, and he has some perspective on
Mac Daddy.
Yeah, he has some perspective on the impeachment of the president. And he's put out some really good stuff
brilliant.
Last week.
Mm-hmm. And he has a channel on YouTube. You can view all of Dr. Manning's videos right there. Yeah, I love that man moving. Moving, I want to thank you very much for calling in. Your hand was raised, so I wasn't sure if you were just listening or you wanted to come on the air. But
yeah,
I'm glad you did, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'll just listen.
You bet.
And,
thanks.
And thank you.
Yep, thanks
moving.
Well, it's nice to get somebody
there,
to...
there you go.
It's nice to get somebody to dial in and hear their perspective. And if anybody else is out there and they want to dial in and chat to either myself or Kel, we'd be very, very happy to hear you. So please feel free to dial in.
And the guest call-in number is 347-237-4318, or you can hit the skippity Skype button at the top of the page if you're in the chat room. I have something interesting here, Tim, that I wanted to read out, keeping with the thread of the conversation. And this is actually a YouTube video, and don't start on me yet. They're so eager to talk, these ones. But I found this rather fascinating. It's called Defeating Islamic Supremacy. I think that we could very handily apply this in the West if we put our minds to it.
Okay.
So I'm going to read it and give you an idea as to what it is.
Okay. Is it something that we could link to in the either in archive or in the chat room or on your blog later on?
Yeah.
Is that something we could maybe look at later? I'm just thinking ahead
here.
Yeah. That's all. I mean, obviously, I'd rather hear it from your dulcet tones on the show live, Kel. So, you know, don't get me wrong there.
What I'll do is that I will put it in my file for Red Fox Blogger and put it in the Red Fox Blogger for later as well. But this is interesting, Tim, and I'm going to give this a read for everybody.
Okay.
After I clear my throat. But here we go, folks. This is interesting. The spread of Islamic supremacy must be opposed if Western civilization is to survive, for built into the cosmology of Islamic supremacy is the intolerance of all that is non-Islamic. The Muslims who perpetuate this striving for global dominance are a very gifted and determined people. There is a toughness and a masculinity not well understood in the West, typical Western mindset, which has been emasculated by politically correct thinking. This underlines how the Islamic supremacists are aided, purposefully or not, by the exceedingly liberal mentality of the West, which errantly believes the Islamic supremacist can somehow be appeased or made unnaturally docile, as Westerners have largely been. Therefore, the struggle against Islamic supremacy is a two-front war. On the one hand exists a military struggle, and on the other exists a cultural struggle. While the West is prepared for the military struggle, it is tragically unprepared for the cultural struggle. What has so weakened the West to the point of unnatural docility is the attitude of submissiveness propagated by a media-driven consumerist mindset in which the beholder has been programmed to think of themselves as a hapless drone of a materialist master. This has destroyed the idealistic qualities needed to bolster the morale of a people under siege by a capable and determined opponent. The undermining of so-called tribal concerns has left Westerners in a malaise of self-worth with no true identity or values to defend. No doubt, the leftist social engineers who engendered this state of being were driven by genuine benevolence, and their work has wrought some lasting and positive benefits. They have instilled in us the very tolerance which Islam supremacy would destroy. However, for the sake of cultural survival, we must now shift our emphasis to the other leg, so to speak, forwarding our newly found identity of tolerance with an iron will against those who are intolerant of all who do not share the singular focus of their cosmology. The very notion of tolerance which we carry forward demands that we respect of Islamic prophets and of freely chosen Islamic traditions. Yet it also demands that we unconditionally oppose the encroachment of Islamic supremacy on the Western soil. In order to effectively oppose the spread of Islamic supremacy in the West, lingering historical animosities of former foes must be set aside for the sake of mutual survival. If we do not set aside the past for the sake of the present, then we have no future. Central to this concern is the Jewish issue. Many of those who blame the Jews for imaginable misgivings, predominant of which is an alleged scheme of Jewish world dominance in which all Jews are somehow secretly working together, I ask you this. If the Jews were controlling world affairs, would Europe quickly be becoming an Islamic superstate? Would the President of the United States be undermining Israel with his every move? The answer to both is a resounding no. While there may be some Jewish influence at play amongst the globally powerful whose obsession with finance has blinded them to the destructive onslaught of Islamic supremacy, they are in no way representative of the concerns of the Israeli nationalists. If all who oppose Islamic supremacy do not have the intelligence, foresight, and goodwill to accommodate fellow travelers, then it will be their chosen destiny to forever perish from the face of the earth. Islamic supremacy takes no prisoners. It is all or nothing. There is nothing weak or inferior or hesitating about the Islamic supremacists. They are a robust and massive enemy. They will never settle for anything less than total dominance. Theirs is an ancient cause and one which they believe is divinely inspired. If we are to defeat this foe of foes, then all of us must be willing to set aside personal and historical animosities for the common good. Otherwise, Western civilization will be but a tiny footnote in some distant historical journal written with an Islamic hand. There you go. What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, I couldn't find anything in there to take issue with. A lot of points that it brings up are things that are worth repeating, which is we are going to have to set aside our differences in order to combat the Islamic scourge, which, if it's left unrestrained and unchecked, will ride roughshod over our Judeo-Christian civilization. And it'll take no prisoners, as you so rightly said in the middle of that. It is a very tough and ruthless doctrine, and there is no appeasement, there is no compromise, there is no negotiation which will have any meaningful or long-term result at all. They will never settle, as you said, for anything less than total dominance. Now, I'm reminded here of a clip from the movie The Terminator. You remember the Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator movie? I'm sure this will ring a chord in the minds of many of our listeners, but there's a point there that in one of the movies, and I can't remember exactly which movie, who says it, but he says that like Islam, the Terminator will never stop. There is going to be no bargaining with it, no negotiation, no compromise. It will never, ever stop until you are dead. And when I first heard that, it was before I really started to look at things like Islam at all. And I just found that just so chilling that there could actually be an entity out there, a thinking entity that would go that far to snuffing out the great things that our civilization has achieved. And okay, Terminator is only a science fiction film, and I never thought I would see its parallel in reality, but with Islamic supremacism, that parallel is right there. And it will never stop,
yeah,
until we are dead or until we have totally defeated it. But it's, you know, it's not something that we,
yeah,
can do at the touch of a button. We are going to have to get out there and do a lot more, and all of us are going to have to pull together in order for that to happen.
It's funny that you bring that analogy up too, because I read the trilogy Lord of the Rings many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And after 9/11, when the movies, when the trilogy movies came out, I was eager to go to the big screen to see them. I very rarely go to the movies, but the Lord of the Rings trilogy was certainly one I couldn't miss. So I decided that I was going to reread the books, read the first one before I went to see the first installment, reread the second one, and go see the second, and so on. I'm reading this, and I'm also drawing parallels in what J.R.R. Tolkien was writing about, was good versus evil. And all I could think of was Muslims. And this is why when I talked about Tommy Robinson sidling up with the Quilliam Foundation, and I put in my blog that this is Tommy on his way to Mordor.
Yeah, that's right, surrounded by orcs And you can just see the parallels. That's exactly what I thought when I not the very first time I saw Lord of the Rings, but after I realized what kind of a threat we were facing, I started to think of Muslims as orcs, and I thought that's such an easy parallel to draw, because you know they are totally enslaved to this evil entity of Sauron in the Lord of the Rings, and the parallel is there again. And Tolkien saw it. He saw that there is a never-ending struggle of good against evil, and we have been, I think, largely because certainly in the UK, we haven't been drawn into a conflict on the scale of World War II for about 70, 80, 90 years. And we have forgotten what it is like to be involved in a fight with good against evil. And we tend to think that if we come across obstacles, all right, they might be unpleasant, but they can be overcome with negotiation, compromise, bit of goodwill on both sides, and there isn't any problem that can't be overcome. But in fact, when you're talking about the battle between good and evil, there is no negotiation, there is no compromise to be had. We either have to defeat it or it will crush us. And that's exactly the position we're in with Islamic supremacism. And the tools of fear, violence, intimidation and terror with the jihad doctrine that the Islamic supremacists employ will crush our civilization if we allow it. And it would be, as I've said many times, it would be a very sad day if that happens, because our civilization is far, far better than anything that the Islamic civilizational model has to offer now or in the future. So we have to fight this. And there are going to be... there are going to be...
We do. Thing we have to do, and, we have to be draconian. I've always fought against draconian measures, and maybe that's just a carryover with my history studies of the Soviet Union or East Germany. But I think the time has come that draconian measures must be taken in the West to fight the scourge, because the scourge will defeat us if we don't. Moving was bringing up President Hussein Barack Hussein Obama. I actually, as a sidebar, Tim, I've had conversations with people where I say I do not offer him that honorific. I don't think he deserves it. And people say, well, yeah, he does, because he was elected in. But I can't bring myself to call him the President of the United States, because he's a usurper and a thief, as far as I'm concerned. And he was elected in under rather suspicious circumstances. But
yes.
Aside from that, when Moving was bringing him up, and that's a very good point, because I always say, as the United States go, so does the rest of us, because the United States is a superpower, but Obama, being a globalist, he wants to bring the United States down to its knees, and that just makes me ill, and it frightens me. This man is alienating all of his allies. Canada and the United States' political relationship is very, very icy right now, and of course a lot of that has to do with the Keystone XL pipeline. But it also has to do with a lot of Obama's foreign policies. I mean, this guy, the foreign policies that he's creating, he's nothing but tension and outright dismantling of the Middle East, and his endorsement of the Muslim Brotherhood, as Moving alluded to as well. This man is creating more havoc on the world stage than any other world leader I can think of, and that even includes Vladimir Putin.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the worst thing is he's in over his head. I don't believe he understands the implications of half of what he's doing. Supporting the Arab Spring and backing the Muslim Brotherhood from a couple of years ago in Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and of course, what we're seeing in Syria now. Where did he think that was going to end? Did he just think that it was going to be a peaceful transition of power from a relatively stable, relatively stable countries that at least largely supported, or at least were not all that antagonistic to the United States? I mean, you look at Mubarak in Egypt. He was all right. He was a dictator, but as a famous American general, I think, once said, well, he might be a son of a bitch, but at least he's our son of a bitch. And I can't remember who said that. Somebody will remind me. And he may not have been very entirely pleasant to the population that he ruled, but at least he was broadly on the side of the Western powers and made for a relatively stable Egypt. The same could be said of Gaddafi in Libya, not a very pleasant man if you happen to be a Libyan living under his rule, but nevertheless, he was in charge of a country which was, all right, not entirely friendly to the United States, but at least we had a working relationship, however distasteful that relationship might have been. Tunisia, well, okay, there's not a great deal, I suppose, that Tunisians, even now, with all the turmoil that's been happening in their country, there's not a great deal of extra animosity towards the United States, but I don't think Obama has been doing anything at all to cultivate the friendship between America and Tunisia for the future. He's certainly not been doing anything to cultivate friendships between America and Libya, and certainly not between America and Egypt, now that the military have thrown Morsi out of power and are cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood. Obama wants to stop all the aid that's been going to Egypt. I mean, what does he think that is going to achieve, apart from more chaos in Egypt? I really don't think he understands what consequences his actions will have. And as for Syria, well, it's not just Obama there. It's there were a lot of people in the West who felt that we ought to be intervening in Syria. I personally think that any Western intervention in Syria at this time would be a complete disaster, but nevertheless there are a lot of people out there, and I think Obama would have been very happy to go with it, to invade Syria and give aid to the people who were going to try and overthrow Assad. And but I just don't think he sees the implications of something like that. If that were ever to come to pass, it would just mean even more chaos than we currently see in Syria and the surrounding areas at the moment. And it could
yeah,
even
yeah, and just
out.
To get back to your quote, I believe that was, I did a quick Google search and I came up with this, and apparently it was Frank Roosevelt, and he was talking about the Nicaraguan dictator Anastasio Somoza in 1939.
Oh, okay, fine. Yeah, I thought it was a general, but Roosevelt. Yeah, okay.
If there was a general that would have said that, it certainly would have been Patton.
Well, I did think it might have been Patton, but because I couldn't be sure, I thought, well, I'll just say I don't know, which is something that I'm sure your listeners realise I do quite a lot, because, you know, I don't pretend to know everything, but if I don't know something and it's important, I will do my level best to find out. So, Roosevelt. Okay, thanks very much for that then, Kel. I think Obama's in over his head, and I agree with you. He should never have been elected president of the United States. I mean, quite apart from the obvious questions over his eligibility and his birth certificate, the voting process that elected him in 2008 and 2012 was flawed beyond belief. I mean, I wasn't paying quite as much attention to the 2008 election as maybe I should have been, but in the 2012 election, the terrible things that were happening with voter intimidation, electronic
oh yeah
voting,
the Yeah, the new Black Panthers and all that at the voting, the polling stations,
The rigged voting machines, the disenfranchisement of the military, all terrible things. I mean, if there's anybody in the United States where you should absolutely make 100% sure that their vote counts, it should be the military. These are the guys and gals who are putting their lives on the line. And some Obama drone... got hold of the votes that were coming back from serving soldiers overseas that they were held back and not counted until well after the voting date had passed. I mean, that's an appalling thing to do. Now, if that isn't treason, I don't know what is. But, I mean, Obama shouldn't be there. And the decisions he's making, every time there is an important domestic or foreign policy decision to be made, he's consistently picking the decision that makes America look bad or makes America weaker, either internally or externally. And it's a tragic thing to see. I can't see him out of office soon enough, personally, and I'm sure...
And it's no wonder that people are sporting T-shirts with Jimmy Carter on them with the caption, "Miss me yet?"
Yeah, well,
Jimmy Carter was a very ineffective president, but at least his heart was in the United States. And I had said this before, I don't know where Obama was born, and I don't care, that's not my issue. But Tim and I, we talked about this last week, in fact. His heart is not in the United States. And if where his heart lies, well, I think we all have a very, very rousing idea of that. It scares me, though, because him being, he's dismantling a superpower. And it's frustrating to me. And when the 2012 election results came in, I was actually on a Skype call with my girlfriends, Beth and Ellie, and we were in a group Skype, and we all had our televisions on, and the final tally came in, and one of them burst into tears. She couldn't believe it.
Yes. Well, I share your frustration because it couldn't happen at a worse time, to be quite honest. He's not only weakening the United States internally and externally, but he's doing it at a time when the enemies of the United States and the enemies of the free world have never been in a more powerful position. You've got Iran coming up on the outside with the nuclear developments, and of course they will continue to say it's peaceful nuclear developments, peaceful, 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 right up to the point where they've actually got a couple of nuclear bombs available, which they will then lob at Israel. You can bet your boots on that, because I'm quite sure that the people who are in charge in Iran are as convinced as Ahmadinejad was when he was they are convinced that in order to bring about the return of the 12th Imam, who will bring justice to the world, it is necessary to create the maximum amount of chaos. And of course, you can't create more chaos than with a couple of nuclear bombs. And I feel sure that that is what will happen. If it's allowed to happen, I'm sure it's what will happen. I only wish I could say something a little bit more positive and a little bit more cheerful, but that's the way I read the situation, and I'm sure I'm not alone when I read the situation like that.
Oh yeah, and he's determined. Ahmadinejad. At least we knew what he was about. I mean, he was a good Muslim. We could follow him like a bouncing ball. He was quite clear about the 12th Imam, and he was convinced that that Imam was going to climb out of the well, and that would be it, game over for the West and democracy as we know it. At least he was pretty much upfront about that. But now we've got, I don't know, I think we've got something much more nefarious going on in Iran. I don't trust this guy. He's supposed to be a moderate. Not a chance. This person is much more nefarious. Much more dangerous.
Yeah. I think I can't bring his name to mind at the moment. But if you look at his history and his form, he is at least as dangerous, if not more so, than Ahmadinejad. He may not come out and say, well, I think it's all got to be done for the sake of bringing back the 12th Imam, but I'm absolutely
Hassan
certain.
Rouhani. Had to do a Google search myself.
Yeah.
I don't have an eidetic memory, and I can't keep these names in my pointy little head, but I just did a quick Google. Yeah, it's Hassan Rouhani is his name.
Rouhani. Yeah, I was thinking Rafsanjani, but that's another guy altogether. Hassan Rouhani. His history and his background, he's been involved in some very questionable activities, which, well, I suppose if you're on the rise in the Iranian political elite, it's rather difficult to avoid a questionable background on your way up, because that's the way things work over there. But he seems to me to be a lot more devious and a lot more... I don't think we're ever going to know what's in his head until he's actually taken some drastic action, like nuking downtown Tel Aviv, and then we'll see the results of what he's actually been up to. But Ahmadinejad, yeah, he came right out and he said, we're going to destroy Israel, we're going to destroy America, we're going to develop our nuclear capabilities and generally cause chaos in order to bring back the 12th Imam, because that's what you do if you're a devout Shia Muslim. That's the kind of thing that if you're in a position of power and you could bring that about through causing the maximum amount of chaos in the Middle East, why wouldn't you do that if you had the power? But I don't believe that the people who are currently in power in Iran are necessarily thinking any different at all. I think they still have designs on bringing about the maximum amount of chaos, and when that chaos is unleashed, they're going to try and make sure that we're as incapacitated as possible. And, of course, they're looking at what Obama is doing in weakening America with the internal domestic policies and his catastrophic foreign policies. And they'll develop these nuclear weapons, I have no doubt, if they're allowed to. And they will use them, I have no doubt, if they're allowed to. How it's all going to pan out in the future with... those guys in power in Iran, I dread to think, but I can certainly say it doesn't bode well for anybody in the West. We may be 10,000 miles away from these people, but the repercussions of what they will do when they get the power are going to be felt around the world, without a doubt.
Absolutely, that is. And I have a clip here, too, that I would like to play. And this is from Dr. Subramaniam Swami, and he is an academic. He's from India, and he discusses about how Islam will destroy all civilization. And I'm just going to play this clip, Tim, and we can take it up from there. It's
okay.
6 minutes long. It's a little on the lengthy side, but I think it's worth a listen. And I'll play that right now for everybody.
Reacted in fury over the Danish cartoons of Mohammed. This was the face of moderation that European Muslim leaders wanted the world to see.
The mainstream Muslims living in this country want to show that we can express our protest in a very legitimate, in a very civil, in a very courteous way.
But this is the other face of European Islam. This is footage of the demonstration outside the Danish embassy in London, provided to CBN News by the NIFA Foundation, an anti-terrorism group. What you can't see in this video is that one of the demonstrators is dressed as a suicide bomber. Even moderate British Muslims were outraged that no one was arrested, even though British law forbids incitement to murder. But it follows a pattern of extraordinary and some would say dangerous tolerance of Muslim radicals. Protests threatening bloodshed occurred in 2004, 1 year before London's 7/7 subway and bus bombings.
Now Tony Blair has been wounded. Pull your troops out of Afghanistan. Pull your troops out of Iraq. And if you do not pull send your troops out, you will get bloodshed on the streets of London.
Again, no one was arrested, and moderate Muslims tried to keep the media from publicizing what for them has become a public relations nightmare.
Yeah, that's disgusting. I mean, it doesn't serve any purpose. These guys don't represent me. They probably don't represent most Muslims in this country, and they do a disservice not only to, you know, living here in the UK, but they do a major disservice to Muslims.
They may not represent the views of most British Muslims, but polls do suggest the Muslim middle is radicalizing. A recent survey shows that 40% of British Muslims want Islamic Sharia law in the United Kingdom. Sharia imposes punishments like amputations and stonings. And in a separate poll, nearly one-third of Muslims agreed with the statement that Western society is decadent and immoral, and that Muslims should seek to bring it to an end. Critics say that European political correctness and multiculturalism, which were supposed to embrace Muslim radicals and somehow westernize them, have seriously backfired. And now Western Europe seems paralyzed by the political correctness that grips the government and the media.
One of the biggest fears for a lot of commentators, whether they're terrorist commentators or commentators on the Middle East, is if they actually address this whole issue of Islam and start to question it, what they fear is being labeled as Islamophobe.
There's a real reluctance to offend the ethnic communities of any sort, let alone the Muslim community.
And there seems to be a lack of political will to stop Muslim radicals bent on conquest. The Dutch parliament has tried to strike a blow against radical Islam by voting to ban the burqa and veils. But that exposes unveiled women to being raped by Muslim men as punishment. There is reported to be a growing rape epidemic of unveiled women in Europe. In London, Shadow Homeland Security Director Patrick Mercer of the Conservative Party says Britain remains in denial and thinks it is protected by what he calls pointless legislation.
But you have to ask yourself, what is a piece of paper going to do to an Islamist fundamentalist, or any other form of fundamentalist terrorist for that matter, and its suicide bombers? Are you going to be able to hold this up in front of them and say, don't blow yourselves up, otherwise we'll get really cross?
In France, the government continues to pretend that Muslim anti-Semitic violence is not a problem, but it couldn't keep tens of thousands of Frenchmen from marching last month after the brutal murder of a young Jew named Ilan Halimi by French Muslims. Halimi was held for ransom and then tortured to death by Muslim immigrants who phoned his family and recited to them verses from the Quran as their son screamed in agony. French conservative political writer Guy Millière.
A lot of Jews in Europe and especially in France are really scared about the future. I have many Jewish friends and they say to me, we think we shall have to leave France to go to the United States, to Canada, to Israel. But France will not be our country anymore.
It's a similar story all over Europe. In the wake of the cartoon protest, a worldwide group of intellectuals recently signed a declaration that states, after having overcome fascism, Nazism, and Stalinism, the world now faces a new global threat, Islamism. It is not a clash of civilizations nor an antagonism of West and East that we are witnessing, but a global struggle that confronts democrats and theocrats. And Europe's problem with radical Muslims is our problem, too. Political correctness has been the fertilizer that has helped Muslim radicalism grow in Britain. Political correctness intimidates the media and law enforcement. But Europe may be forced to choose between political correctness and the survival of its civilization. Dale Hurd, CBN News, London.
And just as a disclaimer, you heard at the beginning of that video that they were calling for Tony Blair's head. This video is from April of 2012. I should have mentioned that. And we all know that the current prime minister today is David Cameron. I also, Tim, I have an issue with this. I played the entire thing. I wasn't going to, but then I decided, you know, I'm going to because there's a lot in there that we could delve into. But one thing that bothered me is that they discussed the issue of moderate Muslim, and my listeners know that I don't believe in moderate Islam because there's no such thing as being a moderate, whether it be a religion or a cult. You're either in or you're out. And I did a show a few weeks back about where will you be when Islam comes to town sort of thing. And I think the moderate Muslims, I equate them to the ones that, well, yeah, we're moderates. We only pass the knives over to the radicals to cut off your head.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's largely an artificial distinction It's largely an artificial distinction that we make in the West that doesn't really have any relevance in the Islamic world at all. If you listen to the words of the Turkish Prime Minister, for example, that's Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan, he said it's not a question of moderate Islam or radical Islam. Islam is Islam, and that's it. And he is perfectly correct. He's speaking quite correctly from an Islamic point of view. There is only one way that Islam can be interpreted if you are a devout Muslim. You can choose not to follow some parts of Islamic doctrine in your daily life, but that doesn't make you a moderate Muslim. If anything, a devout Muslim would say, well, that makes you an apostate because you are not following Islam in its entirety. And if you are going to be a true Muslim, you have to follow Islam in its entirety, Islamic doctrine in its entirety, the example of the Prophet Muhammad in its entirety. You cannot cherry pick. And you either do that and you call yourself a Muslim, or you do not do that and you're effectively an apostate. You're not a Muslim at all. Well, of course, there are some Muslims, I'm sure, would take issue with me on that, but then it's in their interest to do so because those Muslims are Muslims in name only, okay, and they want to try and there are some people who still haven't abandoned their Muslim faith who want to integrate and assimilate and get along with the rest of us but don't want to be seen as apostates by the rest of the Muslim community, so they try and sit on the fence, as it were, and I'm sure they have absolutely no intention of picking up a kitchen knife and sawing my head off or your head off when they get the opportunity. They just want to get along in the same way that normal people living in a Western democracy want to. But to call them moderate Muslims, I think, is a misnomer. I think if you're going to call them anything, you would say, well, they're Muslims in name only, and they're not really Muslims at all. But then, as you so rightly say, Kel, you've got to pose the question, which side are you going to be on when the jihad comes to town, as it surely will? If Islam is allowed to expand unrestrained and unchecked, jihad will come to our streets. And it won't just be something that's in a fort in a far-off foreign field. It'll be in us, amongst us, and we will all have to experience that. And Muslims who are living in Western democracies at the moment are going to have to make that choice. Now, I would not want to rely on any of those people I have previously described as Muslims in name only. When the jihad comes to town, I would not want to have to rely on them to be on our side against the Muslims themselves. And the reason I say that is you've only got to look at examples throughout the Middle East and most recently in Syria, where Christian and Muslim communities lived peacefully together in the same villages, in the same towns for centuries, so I was going to say millennia, but certainly for centuries, without any major conflicts. But when the choice had to be made, when jihad came to those streets in Syria, those people who, I don't know, some people might describe them as moderate Muslims, they decided that they were going to choose their Muslim brothers over the defenseless Christians, and they slaughtered them. They took part, they actively took part in the slaughter. And I can think of examples in the not-so-distant past in Turkey and the Armenian genocides that took place there. Again, these were communities that had lived side by side for a long time in relative peace and harmony. But when the jihad came to town and the call to arms came from the Muslims who wanted to take, well, I'd say take revenge, but who wanted to slaughter the Christians. What happened to the Muslims who lived amongst the Christians? They joined in the slaughter. And we all know what the result of that was. The Armenian genocide took millions of lives at the turn of the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. The jihad terror that we're seeing in Syria has already claimed tens of thousands, if not into the hundreds of thousands of lives, and I'm sure worse is yet to come. And we are going to see the same thing in Europe within, I would say, maybe 15 or 20 years if Islam is allowed to advance unrestrained and unchecked. And we're going to have to ask that question now, because it's no point waiting 15 years down the line when it's obvious that the jihad is just around the corner. And it's going to be a bit late to ask that question of our Muslim neighbours. But it's a question that we are going to have to address. And, all right, it's going to mean that there's going to be perhaps more tension between Christian and Muslim communities or Muslim and non-Muslim communities in Europe, which I'm sure our political elites are going to do their best. They're going to try very hard not to have that conversation, and they're going to try very hard to stop people like us having that conversation, and they're going to do their best to intimidate the mainstream media and other media outlets not to have that conversation. And this is all part and parcel of what we were coming back to right at the start of the program, where the culture of bullying and intimidation that the Islamic doctrine engenders is so pervasive it corrupts everything else that would otherwise contribute to a civilized society. And that's why we have to fight it. It really is a battle of good against evil, and we are going to have to fight it tooth and nail. And I didn't think I was going to have to face it in my lifetime, I have to say. And I didn't think my children and grandchildren would have to face it. But it is upon us. War is upon us, whether we like it or not.
And that's exactly it, in that we don't do this for ourselves, and we don't do it to be gratuitous, ladies and gentlemen. We do it because it is a real threat, and we're not alarmists. We're realists. We know what's going on out there, and Tim and myself, we just try to convey to you our knowledge. Tim is much more knowledgeable than me, I think.
You're too kind.
But I'm learning as I go along, and when you try to have a conversation with people about the Islamic threat in the West, they kind of look at you like you've grown two heads, and it's frustrating some days, isn't it, Tim? I know it is with me. When I try to talk with my friends about it, if they ask me, I try not to bring it up in casual conversation at the cocktail party, for example, but if somebody asks me, I'll go on. And there'll be people listening in, and they're thinking that I'm stark raving mad. But
well,
the threat is there. Yeah. We're seeing it.
We are seeing it right there. And it will become obvious to everybody in due course. But the trouble is, if we only let things happen in due course, then by the time people are aware, it will be too late. What we have to do
is
to get out there now, not like Paul Revere, because he was just one man on a horse. But, I mean, the point is that we have to raise the alarm. We have the tools to do it, which is a blessing, really, that our forefathers never had when the threat of Islam was upon them. But we can go out there and we can make a difference. And even if some people think that we're racist, bigoted, fascist, intolerant Islamophobes, we just have to wear that as a badge of honour, because if it's the only way we can get the message out, then we should be proud to be called racist, bigoted, fascist, intolerant Islamophobes. And if somebody says to me, "You're an Islamophobe," my response is, well, thank you very much. And I explain to them why it's not a phobia and why there is no such thing as Islamophobia, and that a better name would be Islamorealism, or if you're totally fed up with Islam, then it would be Islamonausea. But Islamorealism is a pretty good way of deflecting that epithet back to the person who's calling you. I mean, it used to be, and we were discussing this on the EDL show only yesterday, it used to be that if you were called racist, mm-hmm. that was enough to shut up a lot of people and stop them from pursuing the conversation, because 10 years ago or thereabouts, or maybe less than 10 years ago, nobody wanted to be called a racist, you know, to be thought of as being a racist. I mean, that was a real, real bad thing, and especially if you were employed in local government, or I'm thinking of the UK here, but the same is probably true in most Western countries. If you were thought of as being a racist and you were employed in the education sector or in local government, that could be a real career killer. And I'm not saying it wouldn't be a career killer now. But at least a lot of people can come back with, because they listen to shows like this and they are a lot more aware. Social media is a lot more pervasive than it was 5 or 10 years ago. Blog Talk Radio is a lot more pervasive than it was even only a couple of years ago. And people are listening and they are starting to develop internal arguments in their own heads, so that when somebody comes along and says, hey, you're a racist, or hey, you're an Islamophobe, you can say, well, no, I'm not, because I do oppose Islam. I'm very critical of Islam, but that doesn't mean I'm a racist, because Islam's not a race. It doesn't mean I'm an Islamophobe, because it's not a phobia when they really are trying to kill you. And then if you can still maintain that person's interest, you can explain to them gently, perhaps, to start with, because they may not really know anything about it at all, apart from the fact that to be critical of Islam is somehow a bad thing. You can explain to them why being critical of Islam is in fact a very good thing, and that everybody should be doing it. And if I had my way,
absolutely. And you know what? We're out of time. We're done.
Out of time. I've been rabbiting away
for
an hour.
Time. Oh, but. I hate this. This is probably one of the fastest 2 hours of my week, Tim.
Yeah, it's
but
shot past.
We had some great people joining us. It was great. We had Cat Strangler 101, and now I'm teasing. Golf Dogs, we had some guests. We had Holger, Luchadora, Moving Forward, Tito Esposito, Radio Jihad Network, Rem Soldier. We have Sue from New Mexico listening on the line and moving. Thank you very much for calling in.
Yeah.
Vito Esposito of the Radio Jihad Network is on the air at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, an hour from now, so make sure you're there. Holger has a show on Saturday evenings. He's on hiatus every once in a while. But Holger has a show on Blog Talk Radio at 10 p.m. and Eastern Standard Time, and he speaks about these issues as well. So all these fine people out there, Luchadora, baby, she has 2 radio programs, actually, but she's part of the Radio Jihad Network as well, and her and Eliza Jane, they're on at 6 p.m. on Wednesdays, Eastern Standard Time. All these people talking to you, explaining to you what the threat of Islam is and Islamicization of the West. Listen to all of us. We have something to say, and we're sharing with you. Also listen to Jeff Mitchell of East Anglia and EDL Radio Show, where I'm one of the panelists. And you can hear him at 8:30 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Thursdays, Fridays, and Sundays. And Tim, last word to you before we close this out.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, we touched in some detail about Islamic intimidation and how it permeates and corrupts our society so that people find it very difficult to respond. But difficult though it may be, respond is what we are going to have to do, and we're going to have to be very robust about it if we want to keep our civilization. Personally, I would like to see everybody who's ever promoted the concepts of political correctness and multiculturalism tarred and feathered and hung from a high lamppost. I would settle for sanity being returned to our education system and for people who are coming through our education system to be given a thorough grounding in the 1400-year history of Islam and jihad, and that would do everybody a great service. But if that's not coming to pass in the next few weeks, I guess it's down to you and me, Cal. We're going to have to do the educating for them.
Absolutely. And Tim, once again, it was a great program. Thank you so very much. Wonderful.
Well, thank you, Cal. Thank you, Cal.
Despite some of the glitches that we had at the beginning with the audio, but we got through it, and I think we did very well. I'm looking forward to speaking with you as part of the co-panelist at the East Anglian later on this week. And, of course, I always look forward to our Monday programs. Tim, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you, Cal. It's been a pleasure.
If I don't speak to you before the New Year, Happy New Year. And Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, Kel, and Happy New Year, everybody, all our listeners, and anybody who listens in archive as well. Happy New Year to you all. Thanks for being with us, and have a great 2014.
Absolutely. On that note, we are out of here. And folks, do remember, though, it is mass Islamity. We have to stop the insanity. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Tim and Kel. Have a great evening.
Yeah, good night, everybody.
Good night, Tim. Thanks.
Good night, Kel.